coming up.
What we are here today to talk about is the ongoing debt crisis in Greece and countries that are struggling not only with too much debt, too much inequality, and too little growth and income.
When is the burden of debt so great that it becomes immoral?
Who's responsible for irresponsible debt?
Now, how about lending this country $20 million, you old skinflint?
$20 million is a lot of money. I'd have to take that up with my Minister of Finance.
Well, in the meantime, could you let me have $12 until payday?
$12?
Don't be scared. You'll get it back. I'll give you my personal note for 90 days. If it isn't paid by then, you can keep the note.
Can we solve the global debt crisis in a just and equitable way?
Our guest is Julie Nelson, author of Economics for Humans.
The Ethics of International Debt.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford University. That's where Ken teaches philosophy, and I did for about 40 years.
And today, we're thinking about the ethics of international debt.
Ken, there's something like $200 trillion of debt worldwide. That doesn't include the solar generator I bought from Amazon yesterday. But the real problem is that there are 24 nations in crisis because they can't pay off their debts.
Yeah, a lot of these, I mean, some of these debtor nations are once rich nations like Greece or Finland, but a lot of them are poor developing nations where the burden of debt is falling mostly on the poor and the disenfranchised. All told, John, it's a massive tragedy, a massive human tragedy.
Well, so you and I can sit here and moan and wail about the tragedy, but as philosophers, what do we have to add? We're not bankers or politicians. Our job is to analyze concepts, not loan money.
Well, then let's start by doing what we do best. Let's analyze the concept of debt, and maybe that'll get us somewhere interesting. Let's see, shall we?
Well, it doesn't seem like the most mysterious concept. First, you've got a debtor who borrows money and uses it and promises to repay with interest. Then there's a creditor who lends the money, loses the use of it, but expects to be repaid with interest.
Well, that seems a pretty good start as far as it goes, John.
Thank you. In the right circumstances, Ken, debt can be an extremely good thing. It allows people to buy houses, students to go to college, entrepreneurs to start new businesses. And it allows the lender to make a profit while simultaneously serving the broader social good with his money or her money.
Not every time, not everywhere in history has that been thought to be true, John. I mean, the Bible seems to condemn usury. And Shakespeare famously declares that one should neither a borrower nor a lender be. John, well, did they get it wrong?
Well, I believe Shakespeare ended up penniless, didn't he? But yeah, I think they're just wrong. In the right circumstances, debt is a fair, rational, and effective means of making good things happen.
Oh, you make it sound so simple, though, John. But if we take it to the international debt case, it doesn't seem to me to work that way at all. I mean, your analysis assumed that we get the same agent who takes out the loan, then later has to either repay it or face the consequences of non-repayment. So it's that one agent's rational calculations. But, you know, that's not what happens in the case of international debt when countries take out loans. Not at all.
Yeah, you're worried about international debts. You know, some leader takes out a debt, uses it, gets very popular, then generations later somebody has to repay it. That's a good point.
Yeah, and it is one of the problems because the leaders who negotiated the loan, for whatever reason, aren't necessarily the same as the lender who has to make the decision to pay it back or not pay it back when, you know, the chickens finally come home to roost maybe decades later. It can be a mess.
Well, leaders come and go, but nations endure. Conceptually, it's the nation that's the agent in these cases. The agent, the borrower, the repayer is one thing, the nation.
Well, I knew that's kind of what you'd have to say to make your analysis work, John, but that doesn't change the fact that the people who have to make, it's a fundamental fact, the people who have to make these really painful decisions to impose austerity on their populace so they can repay these debts may not be the same as the people who gleefully took out the debts in the first place. It's like if I took out debts to finance my gambling spree and then everything went awry, I expected my son or even my grandchildren to repay the debts. That would not be fair to them.
Well, yeah, but it can be a good thing. I mean, the World War II generation took out a lot of debt in order to defeat the Nazis. Nobody would have loaned them that money if it had to be repaid in Roosevelt's lifetime. Nations allow one person to make a promise that another person, maybe another generation, maybe another social class, too, bears the burden of fulfilling. That's called an intergenerational compact,
yeah,
Ken.
Yeah, that's a nice theory, John, but it doesn't really address the worry whether you're a simple picture of rational behavior that you started out with that makes it all hunky-dory and rational. It just doesn't scale up to institutions and nations. It's much more complicated when we try to scale it up.
So why does it need to scale up, remind me?
Well, because you get this potential conflict of interest. The leader who makes the loan may be acting in his own self-interest for his own political benefit, but the people who have to bear the burden are different and aren't subject to those same considerations. That's the problem.
All right, so you're suggesting this. The model of the rational borrower and the rational lender won't scale up to countries unless the leaders refrain from making decisions for their own short-term benefit and rather focus on the long-term benefits to the country.
Well, lots of luck with that, John. Lots of luck. That just doesn't always happen. Doesn't always happen. Hardly ever does it happen. It certainly didn't happen on Wall Street in 2008, and it's not happening in the international arena either. It's just not.
Well, aren't you a gloomy Gus? But I suppose in the case of international debt and all the crises we've got, gloom may well be justified. We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, out to look at how debt can cripple economies and why we should care, she files this report.
Puerto Rico is in trouble. During the economic crash in 2008, they borrowed a lot of money to help keep their economy afloat. Today, the Puerto Rican government is $72 billion in debt.
To put that in perspective, that's $20,000 for every person living on the island of Puerto Rico.
Andrew Hanauer is campaign director for Jubilee USA Network, a group advocating for global financial reform. He says debt is making Puerto Ricans suffer.
Between 100 and 200 schools have closed over the last couple of years, and they cut their health budget by $42 million last year. Which now looks particularly bad since the Zika virus is now spreading across the island.
Even though Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory, it can't file for bankruptcy, unlike U.S. municipalities.
That chick did,
or the rapper 50 Cent.
Drop that pro bag off at that club, I'm too rich for the chick. I'm too rich for the chick. Too rich for the beer.
Forbes said this guy was worth $150 million. But now 50 Cent doesn't have two quarters to rub together, at least if you believe his bankruptcy filing. He says he's buried in $50 million of debt.
Lucky for him, here in the U.S., bankruptcy is a process for dealing with debt.
Everybody who's owed money by 50 Cent is able to file a claim. There's a judge who makes sure that people are paid appropriately. If 50 Cent has children, there's measures in place to make sure that his children don't go hungry, because it's certainly not their fault if their father's irresponsible.
But there's no bankruptcy process like this for countries.
In some ways, the international economy is sort of like the Wild West.
And this Wild West economy isn't just hard on your wallet. It can be bad for your health.
Across Sierra Leone and neighboring Guinea and Liberia, Ebola has already claimed more than 7,800 lives.
Andrew Hanauer says we can probably thank foreign debt for that.
In the year before the Ebola epidemic started, and it started in Guinea and then spread to Liberia and Sierra Leone from there, Guinea was spending more money on debt than on its public health system. So it makes you wonder, you know, what would the situation with Ebola have been if Guinea had had the money and the resources to have more hospitals, more doctors, more resources to build, you know, isolation wards and things like that.
Hanauer says the World Bank did a study in the early 2000s after about $100 billion of debt relief was distributed to various countries.
They went to every country that received debt relief, and they found that in every single one, child mortality rates had been reduced. So debt relief was directly saving lives.
Hanauer says there are a few key steps to solving the international debt crisis.
One, debt relief to the point where the country can grow its economy.
Two, implementing responsible borrowing and lending policies.
Third, some sort of bankruptcy process so that countries can have a means to get out of debt if they fall into crisis.
Andrew Hanauer says debt relief is only a Band-Aid. The larger problem is a broken economic system. He says we need to reform financial institutions worldwide, fix trade and investment policies, address tax issues. There's a lot we have to do, but Hanauer says debt relief is an important step. It's helping countries keep their schools and hospitals open, and that, in itself, is a relief. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Wow, Shuka. Debt, Ebola, child mortality, bankrupt rappers. Thanks for brightening my morning with all of that. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today, we're talking about the ethics of international debt. We're joined now by Julie Nelson. She's a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and she's author of Economics for Humans. Julie, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Julie, economics is known as the dismal science. International debt seems pretty depressing. How did you end up interested in such a dismal and depressing, albeit I'm sure fascinating, subject?
Well, it kind of goes way back. I grew up as a preacher's kid. Mm. My father was a Lutheran minister. And it kind of was in the air that we breathed that we should grow up to do something that was of service. My father wanted me to be a medical missionary, and that didn't sit well with me. But I thought, well, why are there so few hospitals? Why are hospitals badly staffed? Those are economic questions. Maybe I can look into economics instead. And that's how I got started going down this road.
Well,
if it looks too grim to you to think of it as all dismal, think of it as, you know, doctors bringing people back to health, and, you know, if economists could get on the right side, maybe we could bring people back to health as well.
It's only the problems in the world that gives us the chance to do good. That's a thought I keep with me 24 hours a day, usually in my back pocket where I can't see it. So people talk about the global debt crisis. What makes it a crisis? And give us a sense, an overview of how bad it is and what's really happening.
As you see it. I mean, our roving philosophical report did a bit of that, but we want to know how you see it.
Defining when a crisis occurs kind of depends on which side you're on. The creditors don't usually think a crisis is occurring until there's a danger of not getting paid back. From the on-the-ground side in poor countries that are indebted, the crisis can start a lot earlier in attempts to pay back debt. And debt is not just about some future generations paying back. Just keeping up with interest payments.
Right.
Not even paying back on principal can take up an enormous amount of a government budget. And that budget could be spent on health, education, infrastructure. It could be employing people, you know, stimulating the economy. And if it's not doing that, if it's all going into debt service, it can become a crisis situation
The roving report gave the feeling that debt really is ruining many countries around the world. You think that's a fair assessment?
The underlying problems, actually, I guess there's two underlying problems. One is poverty that's pre-existing. The other one is this, as one person put it here, the Wild West financial system. There's a lot of ways in which our global financial system is a lot more destabilizing and toxic than it is helpful in this process of trying to help countries get out of poverty.
I read somewhere that many analysts believe that one of the reasons that Somalia is a pit of despair and terrorism and warlordism is it was driven that way partly because of international debt. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
I mean, there's certainly one piece of international debt that feeds right into these kind of things. Export credits, a lot of so-called aid to poor countries is actually a way of trying to promote industries in the home countries, including the arms industry. So if you give somebody, you know, export credits to buy the guns that your, you know, people in your home country are manufacturing, create jobs at home, doesn't do a lot of good.
Where those guns end up. I don't suppose the U.S. would ever do anything like that.
Oh.
You're listening.
Boy, the optimist among us.
Yeah, that's not John's usual role. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about the ethics of international debt.
If the simple model of debt doesn't scale up to the level of nations, we need a better model. We'll look at some possibilities in the next segment.
Debt, default, and national despair and disaster. Plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Giving money to others, then expecting to get repaid, whether it's Bill, Joe, or an entire nation. That's our focus today. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're thinking about the ethics of international debt.
Our guest is Julie Nelson, author of Economics for Humans.
Julie, we want to get to like how to think about this, that simple model that John talked about, and whether it scales up and what's the right model. But I want to ask a background question first, and then we'll dig into that one. My background question is, does the world need a regime of international lending and borrowing? I mean, the American economy couldn't run without borrowing and lending. Could the world economy run without there being credit and debt?
Probably not. There probably isn't need for some kind of system. What we have now is using the word system is kind of an exaggeration. It's a pretty much chaos out there.
It's chaos out there, so we need a better system. But it's not, I mean, not all debt is. I'm just trying to get the. John said that World War II debt is a good thing. I mean,
yeah. Well, there are debts that are responsible and reasonable. The sort of good debt, which is one small subset, is debt that is a lending of money that goes into productive services that then will yield back a natural, amount of increase. So paying back the principal and interest isn't a problem if you use that loan to do something suitably productive. That's not the case for a lot of the international lending that goes on.
Does it make sense to ask what is the typical interest rate for a poor country that borrows a lot of money?
It depends on who they're getting the loans from. Right now, global interest rates are quite low, so there's actually quite a lot of money floating around looking for some place to earn any interest at all. So a lot of poor countries have been filling up on cheap lending.
This is because our Federal Reserve has the interest rate so low that just kind of sets
right.
the standard all over the world. Okay, so this is a good time to borrow money if you're a poor country.
Well,
you still have to pay it back.
I want to go back to John's original thoughts. So I asked him, we were doing some conceptual analysis. That's what we philosophers do, right? In a normal person-to-person or person-to-institution transaction, there's a lender, a borrower. I borrow money from you, you lend money from me. We're each rational calculators acting on our own self-interest, right? And economics has a lot to say about transactions between rational calculators acting on his or her own self-interest. I mean, some people think that's the entire foundation of economic theory. But it just doesn't seem to me to scale up to nations lending to nations, right? It just doesn't, does it work at all?
Well, in the receiving nations here, the person signing on for the country as a whole is usually some finance minister. Now, the finance minister might be signing on to get a loan that's going to fund a project owned by his brother-in-law. That's not an atypical sort of situation in a lot of cases. And yet, who's going to pay that back? There's been limits on how much – or money tends to move very freely among countries. So the profits, if there are any from that, could be in a Swiss bank account by the time the loan comes to pay back.
Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of corruption.
Who pays it back then is – what?
There's a lot of
corruption. is one of the issues. And even if it's not corrupt, it tends to be very non-transparent. That is, the people of the country rarely get any kind of a direct say or even know necessarily what their government is putting them in for.
Is it worse? Okay, so Greece is in this debt crisis. Is it better or worse? I mean, dictatorships aren't at all responsive or well, let's see. They don't have to be directly responsive to the will of the people. I do think they have to be, to some extent, in the long term, responsive to the will of the people, or they have to have totalitarian force that says, screw you, people, I don't care what you think. But democracies, you think, are of as, they have these built-in mechanisms that makes the government responsive to the will of the people. So is it worse for democracies as opposed to totalitarian dictatorial states at all?
Well, I think it can be very problematic for even for democracies. There is a category, sometimes people refer to odious debt, as say, you know, a dictator borrows money and uses it to slaughter their own people. You know, very hard to see that as in any way, you know, ethical that the people should have to pay it back. But sometimes it says, well, you know, in a democracy, though, everything should be fine. You know, but democracies have elites. They have wide ranges of inequality. They have people with more power, less power. Democracy can easily oppress a minority, right? It's not like democracies are, you know, fair, are all fair and equal. Yeah. So even in democratic societies, who pays and who, you know, profits from the loan can be very different.
Yeah, so it's a fraught situation. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the ethics of international debt. We'd love to have you join this conversation. Lend us your thoughts, and we'll be forever indebted to you. And Lisa from San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Lisa. What's your comment or question for us?
Yes, my comment is, my mother was Chilean, and the whole framework that and the way the media has captured the issue of debt, saying that it's the irresponsible countries and things like that, completely forgets that the economic there has been economic terrorism also applied by these financial institutions against emerging democracies, the socialist democracies that happened in Chile during the Allende government, where he had his credit cut off by the World Bank, and. In fact, for example, John Perkins, who was the chief economist at an international consulting firm where he worked, he advised the World Bank, the IMF, the U.S. Treasury Department, he wrote a book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman, where he detailed very specifically about how these financial institutions actually ruined the country's economies, the ones that they were receiving money from. You know, most of them were post-colonial or neo-colonial countries. And by ruining their national industries, making it impossible for them to even pay back the loans to begin with.
So
the whole ethics issue has a lot more than just ethics. It has to do with world dominance by these major financial institutions that are controlled by the major powers in the world.
Thanks for the call, Lisa. That's a lot there to respond to. What do you think, Julie? I mean, Lisa has a lot of thoughts there. Pick out whatever you want.
Right. Well, I have been talking about things from the side of the receiving countries, but that very simple story about creditor-lender, you know, contract also doesn't hold up very well from the side giving the loans. I also already mentioned, you know, export promotion. It has nothing to do with the well-being of the country and not really a lot about expectation of being paid back. I mean, you would think when countries loan money or multilateral institutions lend money, they want to get that interest back. Doesn't seem to be the case. There seems to be, as the caller referred to, a lot of use of debt as a way of getting control over a country and being able to bully it, frankly.
Right. Some people have mixed views about the IMF and the World Bank. Some people really do think of those as sort of institutions that the first world uses to control and manipulate the developing world, and you're telling me there's some truth to that thought. Is that the whole
truth?
There
is some truth. I don't know that it's the whole truth. I think that there were those organizations were founded with some ideas of creating some stability and promoting development. But what happened was certain powerful countries, U.S. among them, got onto this neoliberal bandwagon of privatization, deregulation, et cetera, and started using the IMF and the World Bank to impose this on other countries. Interestingly, it gets imposed on poorer or weaker countries. You have to open your markets to our stuff. We don't do so well on opening our markets to other folks.
Right.
It's a one-way street.
So my understanding is that in the 2008 crisis, things failed on the other end, too. That is to say, the agents of lending institutions were motivated by their own short-term benefits from making a lot of loans, putting together a lot of dubious packages of dubious loans into some kind of derivative that made sense. They were motivated by getting a promotion and a short-term gain, and they did not behave rationally with respect to their own institution's long-term performance. Is that kind of thing a problem on the world international debt stage to countries too?
Oh, clearly. And that's going to be one of the issues coming up if the Fed raises U.S. interest rates. Like I said, there's a lot of money washing around looking for some place to get interest. It's going to get yanked from a lot of countries, you know, where countries are not going to be able to afford it anymore. And those sorts of flows, you know, random, chaotic flows of finance coming in and then leaving, you know, I mean, we saw here in 2008 what that can, the kind of chaos that can create in an economy.
We've got another caller, Helen in Sacramento, is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Helen.
Hi. I wanted to ask your speaker to go in more detail about what she thinks the role of central state banks or the World Bank is has in creating debt, especially with respect to low interest rates.
Thanks for the call, Helen. What do you think, Julie?
I think that, I mean, the if you look at who has the power within the Fed decision making, it's the Fed was essentially created as an organization to keep the banking system working. And it works in the interest of the banking system. Sometimes that's in the interest of the country as a whole. Sometimes it's in the interest of...
So let me ask you a question. I want to get on your expertise as a economist, as a thinking about models of human systems. I mean, so you guys have this notion of a market, a free market, right, in which, you know, minimally regulated markets, open markets, all that sort of stuff, in which there are actors, rational actors who play, who pursue their self-interest and make rational bargains that benefit each side and everything hunky-dory, right?
Yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, yada, yada. Yeah. But, yada, I mean, yada, so yada. I want, how would you actually model what's going on in the international arena? How would you describe this? I mean, there's a flow of money. Money's a good. I mean, there's demand for it, and interest rates somehow are the price, right, that's responsive to the demand. But so what's going on in the international market as an economist? How do you think of it as a theater of something, human action?
Well, actually, there's many people out there who could draw up some kind of model for you. You kind of asked the wrong person that question. I think the first thing economists need to do is forget about our models for a while and look at what's going on in the world and start with that as our material that we're trying to explain.
That's pretty radical.
So is that you think that – well, I mean, so is that because you think that all the economic – I mean, it would be an enlightening thing for me as a philosopher to hear from an economist that these economic models are intellectually, scientifically bankrupt. Is that what you think?
I would call them intellectually half-baked. Actually, yeah. They literally play with half a deck. They assume people are rational. What about people's emotions? You know, what about assume people are autonomous? They act as individuals. What about herd behavior? We see herd behavior in, you know, lending on stock markets and stuff like that all the time. They assume people have no dependents. You don't hear about the economic agent taking care of an elderly grandparent or a child, right? They're just out there on their own. The economic models play with, you know, half of human existence.
So I have come to believe that, you know, you're, you know, I'm speaking as an outsider, but you're encouraging me. So you can slap me down or you can encourage me even more. I've come to believe, I'm a big fan of cognitive science, cognitive psychology, Kahneman and Tversky and all that. Daniel Kahneman won a Nobel Prize in economics for showing that actual human agents don't behave as the economics rational agent theory says they do. It's a mess. And there's this new field of relatively new field of behavioral economics. And I believe it should make you guys rewrite everything that you have ever done, right? And that economics really, as it stands, really is a dismal science because it's in some ways not real science. Are you encouraging me to think?
It's definitely not real science.
Are you encouraging me?
I will encourage you fully to believe that economics, as it's practiced right now, is not real science. It has a lot more akin to dogma. I think of science as being open-minded investigation into something. A lot of economists think of the more math equals the more science, which is kind of silly.
Well, I mean, I don't want to disagree with anything, Ken, or you said, but it seems to me that some of the problems aren't so much with the model of self-interested rationality, but with naivete about what you take to be the self-interested agent and what you take his self-interest to be. I mean, if you think of the bank as the agent, then it's, you know, its long-term survival and making good loans is in its interest. But if you take the particular agent that's making the loan, he may be behaving very rationally compared to his own interests, maybe.
Right, getting a bonus at the end of the year.
Getting a bonus at the end of the year and retiring.
Let's try to get one last caller in here before we go to a break. Eileen in Mountain View, welcome to Philosophy Talk. What's your comment or question?
Hi, thank you for your show and for taking my call. Governments get to borrow money because they collect taxes, you know, cities, states, national, and they expect to pay people back from the taxes that they get. But self-interested multinationals have discovered ways to take their profits offshore, and so they become unavailable to tax, you know, the double Dutch, Irish, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that affect the government's ability to borrow, their credit rating? And, you know, we won't even talk about how they keep up the public health system and the infrastructure.
I don't know. That's a good question, Eileen. What do you think, Julie?
Well, this is part of that Wild West nature of the international financial system, that increasingly companies are able to move across borders for things like tax advantages, which can create a race to the bottom. Okay, you know, you put on a lower tax rate than your neighbor, you know, it's a beggar than neighbor policy. You try to steal their industries, and eventually nobody can collect, you know, taxes if everybody's got to reduce rates to try to attract people to them. You see this among cities and states, of course, as well as among countries.
Yeah, wow. I could mention Texas and my cousin Rick. He's not really my cousin, who used to try to come to California and tour around, try to steal companies to go to Texas with its lower tax rates and exploding oil wells and coal mines and so forth and so on.
This is a very uplifting conversation. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about the ethics of international debt with Julie Nelson from the University of Massachusetts, Boston.
What should we do about the poor nations that can't repay their debts? And how can we avoid such disasters in the future? We'll dig into these issues in our next segment.
Dealing with debt and default when Philosophy Talk continues.
That's what I want. That's what I want. I want money. I want money.
Wow, everyone wants money. Everyone needs money. But when nations have to borrow money, it often becomes a crippling debt. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. I want money with no interest. Our guest is Julie Nelson, author of Economics for Humans, and we're thinking about the ethics of international debt.
Okay, Julie, here it comes, the opportunity of a lifetime. We're going to make you czar for a day of the whole world, all the economies and everything. A day or for however long it takes to get to deal with the international debt crisis. So what's the first thing you're going to do?
I get to do several things, right?
Okay. Yeah, negotiate a higher salary, maybe.
Yeah.
The first thing has to do with debt cancellation, which is the thing that can be done immediately, but is really a Band-Aid for the longer run situation. As long as there's irresponsible lending going on, and irresponsible, you know, borrowing or borrowing being done under pressure, the problem is going to continue. So the other two things that need to happen is, one for the poorer countries, a shift in the way that aid is given. Right now, a lot of, you know, seemingly humanitarian aid is given in terms of loans. As I said, loans have to be, you know, paid back with interest. And not only that, they have to be paid back usually in dollars, you know, or, you know, euros or whatever the lending currency was. And you're not going to get that kind of payback over, you know, from very basic, you know, health and education kind of expenses. So that kind of stuff really needs to be moved to grants.
So, you know,
and then the third thing that I've, you know, referred to a few times is this, you know, better structure for the international financial system, so we don't have this Wild West out there, that there are orderly ways to settle, you know, essentially international bankruptcies. We saw, you know, total lack of disorder in the Greece case.
I think if you ask most Americans, I'm making this poll up, but I think it's true. I think if you were to ask, this is how philosophers do things, counterfactual polls. I think if you were to ask most Americans whether foreign aid is like charity, just a gift, or a loan with interest, I bet you most Americans think that foreign aid is a gift. That's why they're so opposed to it. Why are we giving so-and-so and so-and-so all this foreign aid when we got all this problem? But is that not true? Foreign aid is mostly in the
form of
loans.
Well, I don't have the statistics in front of me, but there's substantial chunks are in forms of loans. Or when it is a grant, the grant may be very much tied to, it may be in the form of weapons or other things.
Has the United Nations or any of its agencies ever taken a stand against this completely nefarious idea of loaning money on the condition that you buy weapons?
On that specific issue, I'm not sure.
I want to ask you, there
have been some efforts from UN agencies to try to get to some better financial structures, some ways of structuring or renegotiation of sovereign debt.
I want to back up to what you said about irresponsible borrowing and lending. Right, because that irresponsibility and responsibility is kind of in the eye of the beholder. Suppose I'm a policymaker, a decision maker at a high level in the government. I'm not like a banker who views. I'm not necessarily like a banker who views the return on my investment necessarily in monetary terms. Right, I may realize, that 20 years down the road, there's going to be a problem with getting this money back, but. Lending is for me an instrument of broader public policy. I may get this guy on my side in the battle against the commies or the whatever. I don't know, is he going to do with it? And am I ever going to get it back? Well, I may not get it back, but it's worth it to me to get him to do my political bidding. I mean, how much of international lending is driven by broader policy aims that are not necessarily tied to just the economics of whether you're going to get the money back?
Oh, I would argue a very large part of it. I mean, the very large chunks of loans have no real reasonable expectation that they could be paid back. Again, they're going into things that are not going to have payback in hard currency. They're going to export credits, which is more about selling things from the giving country than helping create any productive capacity in the receiving one. Or they're about gaining control and being able to put in various kinds of neoliberal policies like the IMF.
Lending nations are thinking of debt as that way, as an instrument of policy rather than just a financial transaction.
Well, let's call it an instrument of control. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. It's not just an instrument of policy. It's an instrument of power that says, if I can do this, I can get the power over this country to make them do things my way.
So
maybe I'm beneficent and that would be a good thing. Maybe it's a corrupt country and I'm trying to clean things up. Or maybe I just want to open that country's markets, to a bunch of private companies owned by my cronies.
So what I'm wondering is, suppose I'm a citizen and I'm thinking about my country and the world as a lender, right? And I'm thinking about should I object to my country wanting to exercise its power through this this kind of subversive, corrosive instrument? Or should I say, on moral grounds, because I stand with the party of humanity, don't do that, country? I mean, I'm not opposed to an international market that's a free and fair market, but manipulate. I'm just trying to figure out how I, as a citizen, should think about my country that does this stuff.
Leaders to not do this stuff, right? I mean, I think there is a real moral and ethical issue here when we're talking about doing the kinds of financial arrangements here that end up really bullying and impoverishing other weaker countries.
So, Julia, another debt crisis that's getting a lot of news lately, and with my 10 grandchildren, I think about it a lot, is the student debt crisis, one that Bernie's going to take care of and Hillary's not going to quite take care of so completely as Bernie, and the Republicans are, I guess, going to pretty much ignore. Does it have some similarities with the international debt crisis?
Oh, yeah, I think it does. Again, that model of, creditor-debtor contract, and the ethical thing to do is pay back the debt because it's, it was entered into rationally with good information. All of that, again, breaks down. The levels of debt that students are getting into now are quite incredible. The idea that an 18-year-old is going to be able to mortgage away their life, we know the brain is not quite, fully formed at that age. And yet we're telling people that, that they have the right, that they should do this. And working at a university, I know that a lot of the kind of going thing now is, we can raise tuition and fees. We'll just raise the financial aid packages, by which they mean the loan aspect. So it becomes a way of expanding universities, expanding, administrative salaries, all of these kinds of things on the backs of students.
Yeah, so, but I'm of many minds about this stuff. And I still
So you're the many-handed economist.
I still don't think debt is intrinsic. Lending and borrowing is intrinsically bad. And not Shakespeare got it wrong. The Bible got it wrong. I mean, because it does take money from here and put it over there.
Yeah. Historically, student debt was not a bad idea. Okay. It is true that a college degree, if you get some skills along the way and if the market is favorable to you, will increase your earning power. And a reasonable amount of debt for that is not a bad idea. What we're getting into now is another one of these kind of, bubbly crisis kinds of things where there's an extreme amount of lending. And that part about getting the skills and going into a market, is becoming weaker.
Right.
I mean, the quality of our education is going down. The debt to get it is going up. That ratio is tipping at some point to where it's not going to be.
I mean, some kind of debts are clearly kind of stupid, right? Debt to finance consumption, mere consumption, is you ought to be careful about that, right?
Right.
Debt that builds your capacity for productive activity that will return an investment that will enable you to reap more than the interest you have to pay back, that's a darn good thing, or it can be a darn good thing.
Right, and that's the kind of debt that can be good.
Right, so the question, how do we make a society, a world, can we? Well, let's put it this way. Can we make a nation or a world in which debt is regulated that way? I mean, is it possible to regulate debt so that people, are protected from their worst impulses, their predatory impulses, and their impulse to gamble, as it were?
I think it is. Before all of the events leading up to the housing crisis, we had a more limited set of financial instruments out there. When there's more limited sorts of financial instruments, you have a better chance of finding out what they each mean. Right? We've gotten so lost in such convoluted ways of packaging and repackaging and reselling debt that we become lost in the maze. And when you're lost in the maze, you can't make good decisions anymore.
So, okay, again, I as a citizen, I want you to help me as a citizen think about what I what kind of regimes I should support to make, debt a functional thing rather than a crippling thing, both at home and abroad.
But Ken, as an ordinary citizen in our oligarchy, you have nothing to say about it.
Well, that's true, but I can at least advocate and I can support candidates who advocate. And one of the things I hate about our media and politics is they cover the kind of gamesmanship, but they never really help you understand what's really at stake. Right, they never really help you understand what kind of regulations, what kind of regime. It's 24/7 cable news, and all they ever talk about is.
I distracted you from your question.
So, I mean, as a citizen, help me think about what I should be advocating for, who I should be endorsing, I'm not asking you to name names. What kind of regime would help ameliorate this mess?
Well, maybe taking it sort of from a personal example might help make the analogy work better. Suppose you. Become bankrupt for some reason. You have to take out a big loan for a medical reason. What kind of treatment, do you want as a debtor in that case? You'd want to be heard by someone fair, who's going to be fair and impartial. You'd want to have the information be accurately reported, these kinds of things, right?
Yeah.
So when we're talking about international debt, transparency about, what sort of debt has, have people been have countries committed their people to? A lot of times that information is really hard to get. Is there any kind of impartial, independent agency that can judge the merits of a particular debt, and negotiate with the debtors and creditors and come to a reasonable solution. No, there isn't. It's basically, often large, powerful creditors and weaker debtors left to slug it out and, who's going to win.
Julie, this has been a really fascinating conversation. It's just really fascinating and eye-opening. A little dismal, but, you're an economist. That's what you do.
I'm an economist.
But I want to thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Julie Nelson. She's a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, author of Economics for Humans. So, John, what are your closing thoughts here?
Oh, good news, bad news. Good news is there's people like Julie that are thinking hard about new models, new ways of thinking, and taking injustice and justice and fairness and unfairness very seriously. All economists aren't just kind of blindly applying Ayn Rand to totally bizarre situations. The bad news is that the problem with which that she's thinking about is so overwhelmingly depressing and huge.
But your thing was problems are a thing that solving the problems is a thing that motivates us every day. Tell yourself the world's problems are there to be solved, and don't surrender and never give up.
Did I say that?
You said something like that. But anyway, this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner. It's already started, and it continues at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now, a man who pays his debts back fast. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, I don't really understand debt, especially this last market collapse, which was caused partly by dividing up iffy mortgages into slices called tranches, which were then also sold. Confusing enough. Then I saw The Big Short about people who figured out that the market would collapse and bet on it, turning failure as a success that failed into a success. Whatever happened to, I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today, I understand that debt. What else don't I understand? Well, the world has a long history of white elephants. Gaudy symbols of great heaping wads of money not really going up in flames but slowly smoldering. The stadiums in Brazil, built for the World Cup, worthless now. There's a $750 million Yongyang Hotel in North Korea, 105 stories, supposed to be done in 1989, abandoned in 92. Just this February, I read that the Yerba Buena Tunnel on the recently completed Bay Bridge in San Francisco has rusted rebar, causing chunks of concrete to fall on the road. Ka-ching! The San Francisco Transbay Terminal, currently being constructed, has had to take an emergency loan from Goldman Sachs. And I read that the CEO of the project has been commuting from her home in Colorado and charging it to the project. $48,000 last year. Ka-ching. In Minneapolis, the new billion-dollar U.S. bank stadium has sprung a leak in its roof, which will cost $4 million to fix, and the stadium isn't even finished yet. Minneapolis first required a public referendum to approve funding, but a, quote, stadium authority, unquote, was able to override the referendum and authorize the budget without taxpayers' consent. Thank you, says the grateful Twin City. Go Vikings. Nobody knows how to build anything anymore, but we're building it anyway, and you'll pay for it. In 1996, the Cleveland Browns moved to Baltimore to become the Ravens and get a new $200 million stadium. After this move, Cleveland residents voted to remodel their existing stadium. Then the NFL created a new expansion team for Cleveland, the cost of which? Yet another new stadium. The San Francisco 49ers moved from Candlestick Park in San Francisco, now demolished, to the $1.3 billion Levi's Stadium in Santa Clara, an hour away from San Francisco. Santa Clara taxpayers are on the hook for close to $200 million in subsidies. St. Louis lost the Rams to Los Angeles, but they still have the stadium, which costs $14 million a year in upkeep and bills. Glendale, Arizona built a stadium for a hockey team. Hockey in Arizona, yes, and a stadium bleeding money. And there's hockey in New Mexico. The Santa Ana Star Center opened in 2006, but ran into trouble when the hockey team it recruited folded. So what do you do with a venue when the athletic franchise is left or goes belly up or is even successful? There are only so many games per season. What do you fill it up with? Comic book conventions, sales conventions, rock and roll extravaganzas, gun shows, hemp fests, monster trucks? But there's only so far you can go, and yet cities here and around the world go nuts for the opportunity to lose money on big, drafty boondoggles that are vacant 90% of the year. Now, sure, there are some successes. The Roman Colosseum, held upwards of 60,000 people, was in use for 500 years. Of course, it was all part of the bread and circuses tactic that didn't really pan out for the Roman Empire. But Rome got its money's worth, and it's still a tourist attraction today. I'll bet you could even stage a gladiator fight there tomorrow and get a crowd. Well, no. Gladiators today would be called mixed martial artists. If you want them to fight in Rome, you got to tear down that pile of rocks. Build them their own 21st century arena with big screen TVs and Wi-Fi, reclining seats, and a special suite for their team of lawyers. I got to go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2016.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Mark Stone, Erica Topete, and Ted Muldoon.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, local public radio, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Well, I hope you took some classes in sexual harassment law. Does the word ka-ching mean anything to you? I'm going in now.